Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mini PC Show. This is Big Talk, Little Machines. This is episode number 24, and we've got a full house today. I'll start off first. We have Brian. How's it going, Brian? We haven't seen you for a little while.
Howdy, howdy. I am doing fantastic. I'm successfully moved into my new place, all excited. As you can see behind me, some of the bookshelves are empty. Some of them are full. Definitely living out of boxes right about now. So things aren't in place just yet, but we're all excited and ready to rock and roll.
Very cool, man. Welcome, Richard, back to the show. This is two shows in a row? Or no, maybe not quite. But we get you when you can slip away from another show. Is that right?
That is correct.
That's nice. Their loss is our gain.
When his other show, quote unquote, lets him down.
Let's head down.
We give him a soft place to land.
So what had happened is Dan's on vacation, and apparently the mail server and the IRC server were down. So I think Dan probably sent a group email out saying, by the way, no show next week. But nobody got the email.
Nice.
But it's cool being here because Dor and I banter back and forth mostly about mini PC type stuff, and I'm very enthralled with mini PCs. I'm just, like I said, very excited to be here.
Cool. Well, we're glad to have you. And Dor, how have you been, man? That good?
Sorry.
Healthy, yeah. At least.
Yeah, I'm waiting for legalization.
He's still kicking.
I've been normal, crazy, I'll say. Kids back and forth. Today we had doctor's appointments. One kid had to have three shots, and the third shot, he almost broke down. That was the oldest one. And then the young one had to give blood and did do like a blood withdrawal, thing, whatever. And I told him, don't look at the needle. Look at your stunningly handsome father. And
you say,
he looked at the needle.
Daddy, you mean you are? Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And he, right as soon as the needle was getting ready to go in his arm, he looked at it, and that was it. It was over. He was no good. And then, of course, like 3 seconds after it, I completely diverted his attention by saying, hey, Danny, don't you want me to buy you that one video game? Oh, and he just straightened right up and completely forgot about it, and then he was okay.
That's great when they're that age.
Yeah. How old is he?
Easily distracted.
He very easily distracted. He is like 8 years old, getting ready to go into the third grade, I believe.
Same age as my little guy.
Yeah. He's the one who just makes me crazy happy when he just randomly runs up to me, gives me a hug, and says that he loves me. And that's the kind of thing I'm going to enjoy it now, because it's going to be in like a blink of an eye to when he's older, covered in zits, calling me an idiot.
Yes. Yes, I can tell you, yes. It is a blink of an eye.
Yes, but more importantly, Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I took my teenager to the park today, and we played tennis for a while after I got out of meetings and stuff after work. So
tennis? You mean you didn't play, like, frisbee golf?
No, we tore up some tennis. So he couldn't beat the old man yet either, so that was good.
Well, here's my real question, Eric. Do you grunt?
I want to. But my teenager's across the court from me, so I can't.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, I want to be all Martina Navratilova on him, but he'd get embarrassed and take off, wouldn't play with me anymore, I bet, if I did something like that.
Well, you'll have that.
Hey, I wanted to give a shout-out to Sean Johnson. He's going to start a new podcast, I heard.
He's not listening to this, dude.
You know what? He's going to start this podcast that's just the opposite of a podcast that I'm on. He's going to start the Room Size PC podcast. It's so weird. I just don't understand why he would do that. But
well, some people like fins. Some people like pinstripes. You know.
Yeah, I like suspenders. Everybody, and belts.
And some people prefer the smell of skunk to flowers.
Do they?
That's what I hear. Everyone's different. So Room Size PCs. I've never. Is that still around?
He's an odd man. I don't understand. I don't understand it either. I think he's doing it just to do whatever the opposite Dor and I do together. Really.
Yeah, like buying iPhones.
No, he's actually starting up the iPhone that doesn't even sound right. The iPhone, what is it? iPhone Addicts podcast? iPhone App Addicts?
Apple App Addicts.
Okay. Okay, it's fair enough. Whatever. I just had to bring that out.
Okay. So I believe we have at least a couple emails that we got in the queue. And honestly, one or two of them I literally just did not see for like 2 or 3 weeks. So I want to apologize up front. Other podcasts say, well, we can't answer all the emails because there's too many of them. What they actually want to say, but they can't say because they don't want to be truthful is, well, see, this podcast is more of a job to me. It's not a fun activity. And they don't pay me to respond to emails. So listeners, you know, maybe if you send me a juicy one, I'll actually read it and answer it. Where we, when we don't answer emails, it's because, you know, it kind of like slipped through the cracks.
Yeah, sometimes I don't get them. I know, see, I don't know if they're not forwarded to me the same way. You're the right one to answer these anyway, Dor. I would just be like,
Think I forwarded them to your Eric at Podnuts account, and for some reason, some of the at Podnuts email addresses have some flaky behavior from time to time.
I do get the Android App Addicts ones all the time, seems like.
I think I forward that one to your other email address, to your real email
address. Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's neat how that works. And then the people on Google Plus are awesome, too, because there's sometimes the way Google Plus works, you get the notification in your email. So then I the two worlds combine in my head, and I can't sometimes keep them separated. So do you want me to start with some emails?
Sure, please.
Okay, this one's from 5150. And he
says, or as I say, Fitty.
Fitty?
Fitty. Fitty.
First door. From this post, it doesn't look like the RetroPie dev is inclined to port to the C2 unless someone buys him one. And that was the RetroPie.org.uk forum topic 2616 Odroid C2. I think we might have talked about this too, though. He seems to think the C1 is good enough. I wonder if there is similar resistance in the LACA team. Maybe a few of us C2 owners should get together and send them boards to test on. Second, I tried both the link in the show notes and the FeedBurner link for episode 22. Both show 404 not found.
Yeah, the second part, he had a DNS error on his local network, so for some reason that wasn't working right. But I'll say, to me, it's like the network effect. You know, we always talk about these mini boards, and we always talk about community, and they have to get a certain amount before people start to actually provide, you know, code back to them or software for them. I think it's the same kind of thing here. I just think the C2 is not yet popular enough for developers to acknowledge its existence kind of thing. If it's just the fact that they don't have one, I'll buy them one.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'll buy them one because I'll tell you, stuff like RetroPie and Laka I think are really cool. And if you don't remember what they are, they are basically both custom distributions you can put on mini PC hardware that gives you a plethora of old school emulators on them. And it also gives interfaces to configure controllers as well. They're both really cool. They're kind of in competition of each other. Neither one's better than the other one, I'll say. They're both really good. RetroPie will allow you to install it as a standalone app on Linux boxes and stuff. So it does provide that extra bit of functionality. But I'll tell you, if someone gives me contact information straight to RetroPie person who wants a C2 or the LACA person who needs a C2 to start the program towards it, I'll contact them and I'll offer to buy them one.
Nice, Dor. I mean, they're doing this stuff that we use for free, you know, basically.
It's the least I could do.
It is. It's the least we could do.
Well, of course, the least I could do is not read 50's email. But
the next email is from Renee, and Renee is pointing us to a link. Renee says, hi, Mini PC Show, and this is a YouTube video for install a Raspberry Pi 2 or 3 and apps without a monitor, keyboard, and mouse from the start. And it's got a YouTube install link and a UBOS install link, UBOS. And that's from Renee Holt from Denmark. Thanks for listening, Renee. That's awesome. And thanks for the link. Have you checked out UBOS or UBOS?
I honestly did not see this email till again. It was already, you know, a thing. So, AKA, like 5 minutes before we started.
You want? I can read. So it says, let's keep control over our data. UBOS is a new Linux distro that aims to make it 10 times easier to run server-side apps for yourself or for your family on hardware or cloud servers on your own, or cloud servers you own. Why give your valuable data to Google or some other data overlord if you can keep it under your own control? All you need is a spare physical, virtual, or cloud computer that can run Linux. UBOS automates much of the administration so you can get on with life. Want to use OwnCloud instead of Dropbox? Charly instead of Delicious? An RSS reader or an Internet of Things app? UBOS makes installation and maintenance easy and quick. And I don't know if that exactly told what it does, but basically run UBOS, install an app, upgrade everything, backups. It's got some command line.
Okay, so I'm on the website, and it's showing icons. You know, it has a row of apps, and it's showing icons for Nextcloud, OwnCloud, Mattermost. I don't know what Circle K is. MediaWiki, number of other apps. So I'm assuming it's kind of like DietPy that enables you to run them.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I just clicked on the link. So.
Hence the name UBOS. So it seems like a platform that... that houses the family of apps that we're familiar with.
I said Beta 7 is now available for PCs, Raspberry Pis, and cloud.
Yeah, I'll say there's been a couple of these things, and this is how I decipher these. A while ago, I discovered a product called FreedomBox.
Oh, yeah.
And what FreedomBox was trying to do was to use decentralized, federated servers so you can own your own data and network with other freedom boxes and create basically like your own social network, if you will. That's the best way I can think to explain it. Okay. Now, with that said, I've seen a couple projects here in the last couple weeks that seem to try to do the same kind of thing. And this sounds like it as well, like trying to put the power, quote unquote, back into your hands. So this is the kind of thing I really do like the idea of it. I don't know if it's the kind of thing that can take off though, but I like the idea of it. I wish them nothing but success.
I was looking into a little more UBOS now natively. You can run Amazon Web Services, so you can back up to an Amazon S3 account.
That's cool.
I like to take the old Spider-Man approach with things like this. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. So, you know, you can house all your own data and manage it, but managing it becomes a full-time job. So, you know, when you're missing things and things start crashing and you need to, you know, prepare for disaster recovery. So word to the wise.
Well, they're saying that's what the Amazon's supposed to help with. What do you do if your house burns down or somebody steals your UBOS device with all that valuable data on it?
Yes.
Backup stored outside the house. That's what. But traditionally, that's complicated. With UBS, it's not. Here's what you do. UBOS-admin-backup-2-amazon-s3. This single command will cleanly back up all the apps on your device straight to Amazon S3's file storage system. With one more argument, UBOS will first encrypt the backup so nobody can do anything with it unless they have your key. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. Really, if it's not encrypted, then there's not really, reason, but if it's not encrypted, it's very self-defeating. You have to have it encrypted or else.
Well, they make it sound easy. And thank you, Renee, for sharing that with us. And there is, he did give us a link to the YouTube video that describes how to get this up and going, I think. I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, it's about 27 minutes long.
So it's installing Nextcloud on the Pi 3 with UBOS.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and anybody who knows anything about me should know this is the kind of thing that I'm an extreme fan of. I like OwnCloud, and to me, Nextcloud is, because it actually is, the next iteration of this. So we'll see, you know, how much further they'll take it. I'm still running my OwnCloud. I really need to just sit down and replace.
Really?
Yeah.
It's shockingly simple to upgrade to Nextcloud.
Well, it also requires shockingly amount of attention. and I'm not the best person to sit down and, you know.
So I interviewed the Nextcloud guys on Tilts, the other podcast I do. And like the day later, on the podcast I mentioned DietPy, and they weren't aware of DietPy. And so DietPy, basically, I don't want to say UI because everybody thinks pretty graphical stuff, but from the DietPy UI, you can select apps to install. And one of the apps is OwnCloud. And all you have to do is install it, you know, check that you want it installed. Once it's installed, download Nextcloud, unzip it in the, I think it's var www directory. Just make sure it's choned and whatever correctly. And delete the OwnCloud, and you have Nextcloud running, you know, on a brand new install. Now, if you're going to do it, and I may get this wrong, so everybody validate what I'm about to say. If you're going to be upgrading to Nextcloud from OwnCloud, you got to back up, I think, your config directory and your data directory, and then copy the files from the Nextcloud zip there into the same directory, and then copy back your config and your data, and that'll work. But it was brutally stupid simple, doing the DietPie method, you know, on a fresh install. I was so excited that it just worked.
That sounds
right. Yeah. Well, and I have heard that as well, but I also know versioning is very important with those config files.
Yes.
And it's a question of are the version that you're on going to be easily upgradable to the other one? And I know, like, on my Pi, all the Pi stuff I saw was completely different version numbers, and it did not seem like it was easy to get the newest of the newest OwnCloud installed on Pi devices. So I worry a little bit about compatibility between configurations. But, you know, I hate saying like this, but the only way I'm going to really be sure is by attempting to break it, aka upgrade it, or just start from scratch. And
Where are you housing your files?
My files are on an external folder.
Okay.
On an external drive. Mm-hmm. External drive. I have about 10 people or so created, though, and it's a question of backing up and migrating their accounts mm-hmm. correctly without having to reset their password.
Gotcha.
So, you know.
Well, we've got a couple more emails. The next one is from Angelo Sanesso, Secretary of the Lions Club of Nag's Head. That's pretty cool. I'm a board member of the Rock Falls Optimist Club, so it's good to be involved in civic organizations, and it's also good to email your favorite podcast. So thank you, Angelo. Angelo emails us about ripping DVDs on the Raspberry Pi. He says, do you think this is possible? What would you recommend? And say hello to the gang. So, yeah, hello, gang. What do you guys think of Angelo's question there? And have you heard of or done it or heard of anybody doing it?
That's a cool idea. And when I saw the email, I thought he was already doing it. I just pulled out of my drawer because, you know, most computers nowadays, or most laptops, you don't have a spinning disk in it. So if you need a drive, you know, like last couple times I flew and brought a Redbox movie with me, I brought my external DVD drive so I could plug it into my laptop because it doesn't have a DVD slot. But I guess I'm going to try plugging in my DVD drive into one of my Pi devices and see what the heck happens.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably play it using like VLC or something, but is there a good Linux DVD ripping software you think that would run on the Raspberry Pi?
Well, Handbrake should run.
Well, it's first Blu-ray, not DVD.
Oh,
DVD
did he say Blu-ray?
Should
he said
be.
Blu-ray.
Oh, he said DVD.
Nope, Blu-ray.
Oh, he did?
Blu-ray. Yep. I thought.
The title is DVD, but in the text of the email says Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, you're right. He did.
Oh. Okay. I didn't see that part of the text.
Sorry. I'll say DVDs should be, quote-unquote, just open and shut. As long as you can load libcss, I believe, mm-hmm. is the library. That's the library that enables the reading of DVDs. Then it's just the question of, is Handbrake compatible with non-x86 architectures? Mm-hmm. And I say Handbrake because that's the default one. That's the one that everyone uses. And there is a command line version of it, which should help getting it to work on these ARM processors. If it's Blu-ray, I believe certain versions of the libcss library can enable some Blu-rays to be ripped. But I'll say this, with Blu-ray ripping, first and foremost, you better have a lot of time on your hands. And second off, you better have a heck of a lot of drive space on
right.
hand. Because those files are gigantic, and they too take a long time. But a Blu-ray should be easy. And I say this again, and I say it again, and I say it again. Blu-ray should be easy. But like, for instance, I bought a Idiocracy DVD. It's region America. I go upstairs, I play in the DVD player, it plays fine. No matter what computer I stick it into, I can watch the movie, but for some reason I cannot rip it. Hmm. And what do you got there, Richard?
Well, I think I sent you an email about this, or a text. Mm, I picked up a 5 terabyte external USB 3.0 drive at Costco for $119.99.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I like that.
Yeah, that's nice.
Guess how much the 3 terabyte drives were?
$199. I was wondering, whatever the same price was, yeah. Nice.
That's a good deal.
Wow, you guys both referenced, you said Idiocracy and he said Costco. I love you.
Go figure. Okay, I'm looking here now on the ever-glorious Stack Exchange, raspberrypi.stackexchange.com. So Stack Exchange has an entire sub-part of it devoted to nothing but Raspberry Pi. It says it's not an effective tool to rip DVDs without hardware acceleration.
Right, I'm assuming you got to do a lot of decrypting.
Well, that's essentially the whole part of it, yes, because you are literally decrypting the DVD as you're reading it. Also, Raspberry Pi is USB 2.0, so that's going to be the bottleneck. That interface and the fact you have to decrypt. But I did find one here that basically gives all of the steps you need to do in order to get it all up and running on a Raspberry Pi and start your ripping. And I'm trying to bookmark the notes now, but our bookmarking system kind of went boom here between shows, and I'm hopefully might have it fixed here. Either way, I will make sure that Angelo gets this back in email.
CC
and
me,
I will
on
take
that
it
one.
Right now. Well, and right now I'll put it in our chat here that I can't stand.
Oh, I know. Google Hangouts, what have you done to us?
Yeah.
You take away our lower thirds. And you give us some weird chat that we can't even go back and look at correctly.
Can we at least do the hats and mustaches?
Nothing.
Yeah, the Hangout toolbox is now no more.
So here's a question for Angelo. I wonder, why would he want to rip DVDs via a Raspberry Pi?
I have the answer.
I can say, because... Pick me. Oh, yeah, you first.
No, go you go. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's mine. I'm old. My kids are, getting old. And all of the videos that I have of them, I have ripped to DVD and made DVDs for, because we used to watch them, if we actually did watch home movies, in a DVD player. That would take one step out. Since I've got like this Pi drive hooked up to my Raspberry Pi, I could put a USB DVD burner, rip them straight to that Pi drive off of the DVDs that I've made, and then set up a Plex server right off of it that way.
Ding, 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 ding. That was my answer.
Ah, man. I don't want to say great minds think alike because I'm nowhere in your league, but yeah.
It seems like you guys are on the same
first
page.
First off, let's not increase Richard's square footage or cubic footage. my logic is because, honestly, Angelo's in a different country. I don't know what they have available streaming to them. Maybe DVD is still the number one way to watch movies and stuff. And some people really despise the idea of dedicating an entire physical big computer or laptop to this mundane task of ripping media. Just like there's little setups out there where you basically stick your hard drive in, you hit a button, and the Raspberry Pi will then, like Derek's boot nuke, wipe the drive. So you're using the Raspberry Pi more of a appliance. I'm a fan of that idea. So this is like using the Pi as a appliance device, but instead of destroying hard drives, you're ripping media disk. And it really, it's the kind of thing I think is actually a good use case for it. It's just a question of how long is this going to take? Because I do not expect any part of it to be quiet.
Right. Why do you think North Carolina is a different country?
I could swear Angelo was in a different country.
You're named Angelo. You got to be from a different country, right?
Nag's Head, North Carolina. I don't know.
Oh. Is that what it says? Am I an idiot?
No, it says Nag's Head, but I don't know.
My excuse is I'm getting that Angelo and a different Angelo confused. Because there was an Angelo in Brazil, too.
Oh.
So you brought up something, and I kind of scoffed it off as you were saying it, but if I plug a SATA toaster dock into a Pi, a $35 Pi, I can do a military wipe on it that would take forever if it was plugged into my computer. That's pretty freaking brilliant.
Yeah.
You could wait.
There's a wait.
I gotta hear that again, Richard. Now you're gonna take a toaster and plug it into a Raspberry Pi and a computer.
Yeah. Wait. Hold on. Here's the toaster.
Okay. Yep. I got the tech. Well, I used to have one very similar.
When I say toaster, I mean basically it's a SATA dock.
Right.
And so mine is two bays, so it looks like two pieces of toast sticking out of it. Mm-hmm. But you have 3.5-inch drives. And so then you could plug a Pi into it, and you could do the military wipe. And I'm not going to remember or swear that I remember exactly, but basically it's writing alternate ones and zeros to the drive several times.
Right.
So you wipe out any latent image on the drive. Now, realistically, if I was ever going to do that, I would just grab a shotgun and, you know, blow a hole through it.
Yeah, much more effective and better time consuming.
So there's ARM-based programs that you can use, you think, with a toaster. Okay.
Yeah, they're very simple. Okay, here's the gimmick. There's already GitHub projects out there, and I've seen them, but I can't remember them, where you hook your Pi up to a external toaster like that, but then you also, via the GPIO pins, you connect two LED lights, mm-hmm. and what happens is the light's red, you stick the drive in, the lights will then blink, showing you, you don't even have to hit anything, the lights will then blink, showing you it's destroying the drive, and when it's done doing the wipe, the light turns green and stays green.
Oh, that's cool.
So all you got to do is just walk by, stick it in, keep walking, come back later, look at the light. You'll know instantly if it's done or not. And if it is, you can just pull it out of the toaster.
So they probably have cloning software and everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, my dock will clone.
Oh, not
even plugged into anything, just power, and it'll clone. But let me not make too much jokes in light of how to destroy a drive. If you do a wipe, if you do a military wipe on a drive, you can reuse the drive, and that's better than recycling.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'll say that's one of the things that I think is one of the biggest, I don't want to say misconceptions, but one of the old myths, like we were talking pre-show, of terminology. There is no such thing as military disk wiping or DoD standards of disk wiping, and there is no such thing as military grade in encryption. You know what I mean? DoD has no official standard number of wipes, or the military, of how many number of wipes.
Then how did Hillary know how many times to do it?
It's just one of those things that, it's just one of those terms that everyone throws around. It's, I don't say common knowledge. It's accepted practices. Realistically, wipe once and you're fine. Okay. The likelihood of anyone ever getting into that drive and being able to get anything back is slim to none. If you do it three times, space aliens might be able to get some data back from that drive. If you do it seven times, it's hard to say anybody would ever be able to get any bit of information back from the drive. So people think, well, seven drives, and then it's just like the torque wrench on the AR-15. Somebody said, well, seven times, it must be the military grade, military grade, military grade, military says we should do it seven times. Yeah.
Okay. We do have one more email. And hey, Dor. This guy, this guy lives across the pond. So this guy, maybe. So anyway, it's...
No, actually, he doesn't. He lives in Arizona.
Dor.
But go ahead.
He lives in Bristol.
Go ahead.
I don't know how to say his name.
You mean Zoke?
Zoki?
Zoki.
Yeah, Zoke lives in Arizona.
Yeesh.
But go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead. All right. Anyway, he's given us a link to a Wikipedia article on BBC Micro. The BBC Micro computer system kind of looks like a TRS-80 to me. But he says, the BBC Micro was just amazing for its time. When I was at school, we had an entire lab devoted to the BBCs. If you talk to anyone of my age from the UK, they will know about them. So no, this isn't the first time the BBC has made PCs or worked with other companies to make PCs. But very few people outside the UK know about it. Keep up the good work, guys. Okay. Did we talk about BBC computers before?
We talked about the new, I believe it's called the BBC Micro. I thought that's what it was called.
Okay.
Where it's one of those little teeny computers. The difference is it had a couple built-in LEDs on it, and it had like four buttons at the bottom of the board. Mm-hmm. So it's like a Pi competitor is what I'll say.
The one he sent the link to had a 2 megahertz processor in it.
Did it have a hand crank also?
16 to 32 kilobytes of memory, and it had floppy disks, and a 20 megabit hard drive.
Yeah, so this is the kind of thing I'll say, me as a American, I never knew about this kind of thing. It might as well be, you know.
Okay, the new computer is the BBC Micro:bit.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, and so they had the same kind of thing, quote unquote, back in the day. This is the kind of thing, you know, I just want to see people do more of. Who knew they were doing it before? I sure the heck didn't. And Zoke is, he currently lives in, I believe, Arizona area, and he goes to stuff like DerbyCon, which I believe is in Tennessee, maybe Kentucky, to conferences. And I keep getting close to going to meeting Zoke and shaking his hand, having a beer with him, but it just seems to not happen. But Zoke, you hear his voice. There's no doubt he's from, well, to an American, it could be Britain or it could be Australia.
Just got to have the right ear for the to really pin that down, huh?
Okay, right, or just on the back side. All right, this is a two-side board. I'm looking at it, and there's a couple of push buttons, and then there's a grid of LEDs, and there's surface mount. So it's a 5x5 grid. Yes,
I've seen these.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. I really like the idea of it, but it's really hard, as far as I'm concerned, anything to catch up to the rate of the Raspberry Pi and growing. Oh. And I got a little bit of Raspberry Pi news, and that is the Pi podcast is now dead. Literally, it's like 20 episodes. Not in typical fashion, I want to say, not even 20 episodes. And the guys basically said, we're too busy to do this. One of the guys was a Raspberry Pi developer, and the other guy actually worked for the Raspberry Pi.
Oh, that's too bad.
I'm not going to be a guy that reads into things.
Well, they probably are too busy then.
28 episodes is how many they have. And I will say, it's the kind of thing, if they're just too busy, I'll just say it like this. If they're just too busy to do a podcast once a week, then they're doing something wrong, period. Offload some of the work. Offload some of the work. Yeah. Ask some people for help. Ask the community to help editing. Ask the community to help posting. Ask the people to help doing notes gathering, because it's not too much work. And community like Podnuts would be more than willing to support you.
Yeah, and send us a voicemail at 7076-PODNUT. Anytime.
Sure, anytime. Yeah.
That was it. That's cool. That was it for the email store, I believe.
Okay, since our note system was broken, I didn't realize it, and it's still not technically fixable, even though I went and I quote-unquote fixed it, and after the first link I was successfully able to bookmark, it broke again.
And I want to let you know, I may have to jet out of the podcast a little early. I've got a friend who's actually in town from Japan who's supposed to be coming over here sometime around 10.
Okay. Was there any news here from the last couple of weeks that any of you guys thought was cool, want to talk about?
There's a couple items I want to hit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
So let's see. I'll take the item. I don't know if you sent it to me, I sent it to you, or how it got to you. Basically, it's running Raspberry Pi, let's see, line 208. And so it's Raspberry Pi, Raspbian Jesse image with Plex, Deluge, Couch Potato, and SickRage, which is a fork of SickBeard. Also, it has a mini DLNA server. So Plex serves out movies, TV shows. The interface looks just like Netflix, and it's frickin' amazing. Couch Potato, a buddy of mine told me he's running something similar to this. In a Docker container. And so I started taking a look around, and I kind of Googled and came up with this. And I decommissioned my PiAware. I had a Pi out in my Tiki hut with a software-defined radio hooked up to, and it was monitoring transponders and ADS-B messages from aircraft flying overhead and feeding them to FlightAware. So I grabbed that thing, threw it in my data center in a drawer. Did I say draw? Drawer.
Draw. What was that accent?
New York.
And threw it in there. And I'll tell you what I finally broke down and did this. I bought like a 5-pack of 16 gig micro SD cards. Now I can slide out the PiAware micro SD card and slide in a fresh, you know, image. And this image, so it contains Plex, which I told you is the video player, Deluge, which a lot more people might know what transmission is. It's basically just like transmission. It's a torrent tool. Couch Potato searches for movie torrents, and Sick Rage or Sick Beard search for TV show torrents. And there's a number of different tools it can use to download, and Deluge is one of them. So it's pretty much pre-configured. Now, it is pre-configured to run on a Pi. So it's looking to download the Pi Home downloads directory, and the movies are in like Pi Home movies, and the TV shows are in Pi Home series. And what I did is I Door talked me into running. What was it? What was the NAS you talked me into running?
Oh,
Open NAS, Free NAS.
Open Media Vault.
Open Media Vault, that was it. So I was running Open Media Vault, and I actually decommissioned that because somebody supplied me, Door, with a Raspberry Pi Banana Pi M3. So I'm actually running everything I ran on a former Vista box on the Pi M3, Banana Pi M3, that is. So it's an octa-core, and so I'm running the a Plex server on that along with Time Capsule for all of the Macs in the house. And that's plugged into, 3 terabyte drive, external drive, I guess. And so since I decommissioned the, I forgot the name already, the Open Media Vault, I finally unplugged the drive when I saw this and plugged the 3 terabyte drive that was plugged into the Open Media Vault into the Raspberry Pi 2.0 with that image. And what I stupidly had it running, and I mapped, I sim-linked over to the SATA drive, the movie directory, and the TV directory, but I didn't sim-link over the download directory. And I'm like, why did this stop working? And when I, a command I use almost every day in the command line world is df, because sometimes I don't remember what the drive is named, but it also shows you, hey, if you see 100% show up on your df, something's wrong. So it's like, whoops, this is 100%. I'm like, why is it 100%? I'm like, well, it must have downloaded stuff to somewhere. And sure enough, so I copied that over, sim-linked it over to the hard drive. And I'm not ready to give at least my version of this a, full stamp of approval, thumbs up reliability-wise. It does seem to work. It does seem to need, some sort of TLC once in a while. Because the Deluge that is handling, the torrent downloads seems to get stuck once in a while. And it might just be me and my setup. But I'll tell you what was happening. So I had the Plex server running on a box, and when somebody wanted some video or whatever to watch, they'd say, Dad or Honey, and could you download this? And then I would, spin up X11 VNC on the Banana Pi M3, and I would go into it. I'd pop open a browser, pop open Pirate Bay. I would then pop open another browser window with transmission, and then pull it down. So only I hold the key to the kingdom to do that. And the cool thing about this is anybody in the family, anybody in the house with a browser, could go to Couch Potato or Sick Rage and select a TV show or select a TV show or a movie and select it to be downloaded, and it'll automatically download it. It'll move it to the right directory, and it should update the index on Plex so that, hey, it's available.
Nice.
Yeah, see, this to me is golden. I will say, I'm going to speak as Joe Hecht here for a second. You can just make this yourself. You can just build it yourself.
Sure.
And I'm sure it's not difficult to build yourself, but it's awfully dang convenient to be able to download and run it for at least litmus testing purposes. Yes. Is this something I want to continue in on? Is this something worth my time, worth my investment? I love the idea, because Couch Potato and Sick Beard or Sick Rage has been out for years, and it's gotten a heck of a lot better. When it first started, you had to go and you had to find the RSS feeds or the Twitter feeds that hosted the movies that you wanted or the shows that you wanted, and then manually import them into the systems. So I'm glad to hear they have a browser-based interface. You just log in, search,
Yeah, you type in, like, hey, I'm looking for this, and it'll show you a number of selections. It'll make a best guess, and then you can say, hey, I only want this quality or better. You know, you can say any. It'll pull down. In one of my buddies that's been running this tells me that if you want a higher quality, like if you just say best quality, and it finds something of low quality, pulls it down, and then finds something later, better quality, it'll pull that down in the future.
Mm, that's nice.
Nice.
So, really, just like you were saying, Dor, my goal would really be to install SickRage and Couch Potato on my M3 and throw the Raspberry Pi 2 back in the Tiki Hut with PiAware on it.
Yeah, and I'll say my logic is also with this kind of thing, this might be the perfect use case for a super cheap device as well, because there can't be a lot of processing power needs or RAM needs to load up browser sessions and download torrent files. So you could use, if you wanted to, probably a chip or a Orange Pi 1 or a lesser device. But I do like the fact of having, now again, to funnel Joe Heck, the Banana Pi M3 octa-core. It is an octa-core, but it is an octa-core. It's a dual quad-core system, I found out, because he said it and I went and looked into it. Four of the cores are for lower performance tasks, and then when it needs more performance, it switches to the other quad-core. So it's still a octa-core. But I like the idea that you can actually stack multiple services on a small mini board computer and have it handle it and not flake out, not die, not have to be rebooted once a day, not randomly lock up kind of thing. The BitTorrent issue, this is what I don't like about BitTorrent. It's that other people don't like it. For all we know, it's your ISP yes. seeing BitTorrent activity and then once in a while just saying, kill it, to where you have to manually restart mm-hmm. it.
Correct.
You know, it's one of those things that comes and goes kind of thing. But when it works, it sounds like it works good enough.
If I could channel Joe Hecht real quick, too, the username's Pi, the password's Raspberry. It's right on the main
But
page.
I'm sure you can change that, which is the PASSWD, and you're done.
So I'm going to have to cut out, guys, but thanks for having me, and I will upload this to you, Dor.
Thank you.
There's something else I was going to say, too, but I don't remember what it was. Must not have been important.
Okay. So, yeah, this is good. I will say it has to come with disclaimers just because. Questionably legal activity. As far as I'm concerned, if you subscribe to normal TV or you subscribe to cable, you're entitled. You should be entitled to download these files. I'm not a judge, I'm not a lawyer. The other caveat it comes with is this is just a quote unquote random thing we find on a torrent site and download it. We have no idea what other wares could be included with this distribution. That's why I say, to me, it's good to use for testing purposes only. If you really want to do this full time, I say start an Armbian instance or a DietPi instance and just build it yourself. Because most of this shouldn't be extremely complicated. And then you get the option, if you want to customize it a little bit more. Instead of using Deluge, maybe use something else. Change up the ports if you want. You can do all kinds of things.
Yeah, I believe these things are just available by apt-get install. So you could just drop down the command line and install them on your DietPi install. So install Plex with a DietPi and then just pull one of these in. Now, I don't know the metrics on Plex, but could a low horsepower device run Plex?
Well, you guys had Plex guy on Tilts, I believe, and what he's indicating is the way that they're intelligently, quote-unquote, transcoding all the files is they purposely do everything in their power to not tax a processor. They do a little bit of processing and then wait, do a little bit of processing and wait, and they try to stay ahead of the needs of the clients. If you're trying to do 4K stuff, you might have some problem on any of these Pi devices. If you're doing normal 1080p kind of thing, you might be able to literally handle two or three streams until you start seeing artifacts or buffering happening on the Pis. But I would expect a properly compiled Plex server shouldn't have too many issues on most of these Pi devices, is my logic. Plex is starting to officially support ARM even more. They basically announced a formal working relationship with the NVIDIA Shield people to have Plex running on at least Android ARM-based devices as a server. So they should be getting better at that as well.
That's still cool. And I got to say, one of the things that I really appreciated with Plex was the ability to log in to a device. So I have two Plex devices on my network. And then from whichever one I hit, select the content on the other one, or somebody remote that shared their Plex services with me, and just select the server. You know, it doesn't matter what device on my network I hit, I can get content from anything.
Right. And then the other thing I like is hypothetically, I have my wife upstairs, and let's just say, for example, she can't find a movie, and I know it's on the Plex server. I can go into my Plex interface and say, select play, and then it will ask me if I want to play it on a different device as well. So I can say, play this on the Roku, and then it will automatically start on her device like she hit play.
You know, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the little things about Plex, I think, that are just that is just gold.
I got to check that out.
And yes, now it gives you the opportunity to troll your phone.
Well, I have to say, guys, I haven't even thought about using BitTorrent to download content, just because I'm a little leery on doing that from a legality standpoint. But I'm highly intrigued about Silicon Dust Home Run HD Prime. That takes a cable card. So cable cards for me are about $2 a month for a rental. And with a cable card and the Home Run HD Prime, I get to stream at least 3 streams on a single box.
Yeah, there's a lot of limitations that come with that. The streams are flagged. Some streams are flagged, you can't stream. So some random content you go to watch will be flagged, you cannot stream it. You will also have content that will be flagged, you can only watch once. Then you'll have other content that's flagged, you can watch and record. So with that cable card comes with the agreement that you don't have total control over everything coming into that stream. They do.
Right.
So that's just one of the caveats got to be aware of, because you are not going to be able to do everything you want to do with everything coming over that cable card. And the only reason I know this is Pat and Dan Fry, two of the guys that are originals from the other show, they used to be huge Myth TV guys. I mean, huge. The one guy developed a whole bunch of tools to work with Myth TV, and they both recently just said, we're done. We're never using the system again. We're just going to stream our stuff using stuff like
Kodi,
Hulu, Netflix, Kodi, stuff like that, just because of the extra hassles that came with the HD Home Run, because they both had the one thing I wanted to bring to the show, and it's hard to get the full grok of this, and I hate using that word. It is on line 209 in our notes. The retro NES is coming out November. You know, geeks and nerds everywhere are, you know, panting, waiting for it kind of thing, including myself, just because it's cool. That's a $80 device, I want to say. And if you want an extra controller, it's like $30. Well, this guy posted, and it's over here on Lil Putin. He basically 3D printed his own case and made his own mini classic arcade system. Now, here's the differences that he did. Number one, the 3D printing he has for the NES is exquisite. This is professional grade looking, is all I gotta say. It looks literally exactly like a small NES with working buttons on it and everything. But here's how he went over, above, and beyond, even what that official retro NES is doing, okay? He also put a Raspberry Pi 3 in there, and he put a Arduino, I believe, Uno inside. Now, the Arduino Uno is connected to an NFC reader, okay? Then he actually printed mini NES carts. And inside those mini NES carts, he has NFC tags. And then he programs those tags with the perfect name of the files. So he has, like, Super Mario Brothers 3 mini cart that looks like Super Mario Brothers 3. He put the NFC tag in it. He then programmed it with the perfect file name of that game. He then opens the door, pushes the cart in, pushes the cart down, and it click, 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 clicks. And when he does that, the Arduino reads the NFC tag, sees the file name, and then when he hits the power button on the Pi, it loads the game right up.
Man.
This guy deserves, I don't know, a job somewhere.
Yes.
Because this guy is awesome. That's all I got to say.
Oh, the video is cool. Because he has the full size there, and he picks it up, takes it away, and drops in the one he printed.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing where I'm sure legally he can't sell, but hypothetically, if he started selling these things, people would probably pay him $100 to have something like this with, you know, a certain number of carts and games in them. And he said for giggles, he printed also a 3D printed a mini game controller as well. Like if you fast forward to like 4 minutes or so, you'll see in his hand two scales of the system. He printed a mini game controller that is fully functional and works perfectly as expected.
Yeah, nearly 5 minutes in.
Yeah, four like 45 is when the guy starts to see it.
This guy's got mad skills.
Yeah, this is amazing. And it's so tiny. Look how tiny this thing is.
Yeah, all I gotta say is if this guy actually does turn out to live physically close to me, he better hope I never find out. That's all I gotta say, because I will never stop harassing him to build one for me too. This is just the epitome of mini computing, the epitome of hacker mentality and maker mentality, all wrapped into one, into a heavily polished thing. That
can we have an award show at the end of the year and give him the, you know, mini PC guru of the year award?
He definitely deserves something. That's all I gotta say. Deserves something. This is awesome.
Freaking brilliant. Love it.
Yeah. And again, Lil Putin, one of my favorite sites for these mini things. They do have the LPX show, the podcast, but I swear he hasn't done an episode in since June 17th. So almost 3 weeks kind of thing. So hopefully he hops back on that and does more shows, because I do like the content he's had. But this little mini NES is just genius, genius. I literally giggled like a little girl when I saw it. And I sent it to a couple friends. Okay, one other thing I wanted to... one other thing I want to talk about on line 213. Banana Pie. Okay, the official quote-unquote Banana Pie, original Banana Pie M1 people. Looks like they're coming out with another brand new board. I've had mixed feelings in my tenure of mini PC-dom, which is a couple years now, with Banana Pie. The original Banana Pie, I had great success with. The Banana Pro, I've had great success with. The M1 seemed kind of weak. The M2 seemed kind of dumb to me. The M3 they had some inconsistency and hard in manufacturing. Some people saw extreme overheating problems. I also think the OS was pushed out maybe before it was ready, and hardware maybe pushed out before it was ready. But since then, it's stabled a lot out, where everyone I know now with an M3 still running it, they're pretty happy. But they're coming out with another one. This is the Banana Pi M64. So it's, I believe, their first true 64-bit processor, and it is a A53 quad-core processor. All the other normal, quote-unquote, bells and whistles that come with your normal Pi device. Two USB ports, 5-volt in ports, 40-port GPIO pin, 8-bit camera interface, HDMI interface. It does have 802.11 BGN. Sorry, Richard, no AC. Right. Bluetooth 4.0, TF or micro SD card, 2 gigs of RAM, which is shared with the GPU. That's one of the caveats thing. Does have reset and power button. This could be like they're coming back to stability is what I'm hoping. I have good hopes for this device to be a rock solid device. Yeah, and it looks like it's pretty well documented already. I don't think you can buy it yet. Does have a true gigabit LAN, which is one of those things, you know, I'm kind of a stickler for. If you don't have a gigabit LAN, you're really limiting a lot of what you can do.
I agree.
There is no SATA port. Sadly, I will say that's one of the things I really do enjoy about my Banana Pro. And no USB 3.
Yeah, I would trade the SATA for USB 3 in most cases.
But to be honest, I think most other people would as well. I liked SATA in the beginning because it's an old technology. It's standard. It's easy. You know it when you see it kind of thing. And that means you can take older hardware, rip it into pieces, functionally use the hard drive in something like this. But USB 3 is becoming everywhere standard, the norm kind of thing. With that said, this is using standard TF microSD cards. Okay, 2.5, 3 years ago, Scott Moulton, my hard drive died, a hard drive forensic expert, told me SD cards, is the next generation of them has already been approved, and they will be coming out soon. It looks like they're finally starting to come out. They're not called micro SD cards. I want to say, it was called UFH cards.
Something
they're
like
the
that.
Same, almost the same form factor as micro SD. Really, the only way to look at it and notice is when you flip it on the back. On the micro SD cards, all of the connectors are on one edge, and they're just right there, and they're of different lengths. The new version of them, there's some connectors near the middle of the card. So microSD will start to be deprecated and taken out of existence. It's probably going to take a good 2 years for it to be fully dead, but it is now literally counting down. The actual clock has started.
Oh, I've never heard that. I'm going to have to dig into that. You said UFH?
I'm trying to find it really quick. Here you go. I do my search in Google, and my link comes up. How convenient. Okay, I'm going to put it at the bottom of our notes, guys. If I go to the show, line 215 is where I put it at. UFF cards.
Not UFC?
And if you take a look, not UFC. And it's and of course, I hate saying this, of course, in typical fashion, Samsung is one of the people who's probably going to have this in their phones soon, like really soon, like hyper really
all
right. soon.
All I have to say is flock me. The card they're showing, that link, is 256 gig. That's more than the hard drive or the SATA drive on my frickin' MacBook Pro.
And that's more than the hard drive in my laptop upstairs, which is an SSD, and it's more than one of these desktop computers down
mm-hmm.
there. Yeah, and it's the size of a micro SD card.
Which means you can lose it in a heartbeat.
Which means you can just drop it and it's gone forever. Yeah, and if you take a look at the back of the card, most of the connectors are near the middle of the card. So that's really the easiest way for me to tell somebody to tell the difference. But these UFS cards are coming. They are inevitable. Right now's the time. Don't invest a lot in micro SD card technology here.
Yeah, unless you plan on having a lot of legacy Pis around.
And, you know, that might be okay. And now I'm sure one of the things that's going to come out is a micro SD card adapter connector. You slap your UFS in there. I will say that's one of the reasons why they're moving forward with this new card is the higher capacity, number one. But the real reason to do it is read and write speeds, I believe, are literally going to be like 4 to 10-fold when this thing becomes fully.
Oh, that's stinks crazy then.
That is, but that's really one of the reasons why they're doing it. And that's going to mean with our Pi devices, the bottleneck then should not be the bus to the IO of the disk.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
And it means like we might not need USB 3.0 devices hanging off of it or SATA devices hanging off of your device just for extra storage. You can just use one of these. Oh. Now, what I can see happening in the future is having Pi devices with multiple card slots mm-hmm. on it. Because you want to have one maybe for the OS and one for the data drive.
Mm-hmm. And I like to do that, period, when you have a device that's unattended.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of having, like on my one computer here, I have a spinning disk as the main hard drive, and then I have a large SSD as my secondary device. I even have my temp, my VAR, and everything mapped to RAM, just to make sure that my drives are not taking any extra punches to the gut kind of thing. And I love the idea of partitioning off heavily used, heavily rewritten data onto a drive that I expect to fail, where I have the actual operating system on a solid mm-hmm. drive that I don't have to worry about. Okay, let me do one thing here in the notes, guys, besides highlighting the things I want to make sure that I highlight to remember. So the notes are definitely going to look different this week, guys. Sorry about that. Let me make sure I have Angelo's thing highlighted as well. The only other thing I'll say is I've thought a lot about, and I shot a link to Brian about this too,
yeah.
That Upboard.
Oh, yeah. I was hoping you'd bring that up.
Well, I'll say last week I was a little poo-poo-ish on it. Don't get me wrong. I'm a fan of the board. I'm a fan of the idea. I'm a fan of the ease of mental stress on an x86 mini computer. That was at up-board.com, I believe. I love the, you don't have to worry about it. You know everything that you need to run on it is going to run on kind of board idea. This to me is the perfect, all I need is a browser for someone to use.
It's up-board.org.
Thank you, thank you. But it is, again, the cheapest version of it, I believe, $90. But if you jump it up to, I think it was 4 gigs of RAM, which to be honest, I mean, isn't 4 better than 2? I mean, I want to say it was $150, which still isn't out the realm of overpriced. It's just higher. So I'm going to keep thinking about it at least, but I don't know if I'm going to get one. I will say, if I do have one, then it's easy for me to say I'm podcasting from a mini computer and doing my post-production on a mini computer, because I know all my software is going to run, period. It's just a question of how long it's going to take to encode, transcode, open, and, you know, do that kind of stuff.
Okay, so here's what I want to do with something like this. So I'm want to set up a VMware lab so I can set up and mimic what my clients have going on or the technologies they have going on so I can do a test deployment. Now, there's a bunch of different ways to skin the cat. There's some, Revelo has like a virtual system that you can get for a couple of days if you reuse different email addresses, and or not reuse, but use. I'm like, well, for a $99 computer or, you know, 120 with 4 gigs, if I could run vCenter and, just throw them together, pretty much I could have a shoebox with like 4 of these boards in it and a switch, and I could run basically a small vCenter with a number of hosts, and I could test things.
That's a pretty good idea.
And it will functionally work in the exact same way as it would be when you go on site. And I'm a big fan of practicing what you're going to do at work while not at work, because most works have a hard time with letting you do research and development on the clock. They want you to come in already knowing everything. And I truly believe the best techs I've ever dealt with are the techs that go out of their way to set up environments at their houses to do this kind of thing. So I'm with you, man. And that's one of the things I like about this. I know I want to like set up a rig for my kid to do game creation kind of thing. And all the tools exist on Windows. Every single tool that I find that is kid friendly yet powerful enough to make an actual game are all on Windows. So what choices do I have? You know, I like the idea of now I can spend $150, get a small box with 4 gigs of RAM on it, put in a little case, and I can easily, now it does have built-on storage. And here's one of the only thing I worry about. Having eMMC built into the board, the hard drive built into the board, how easy is it for me as a technician, quote-unquote, to clean up viruses and infections and rootkits on that kind of device?
Okay.
And if I have to reinstall, is it as easy as just putting up a USB drive to it and it will automatically every time boot straight to it? Or is it possible a rootkit will then first boot from the internal and then go back to the USB? Yeah, that's one of the things that I guess I over paranoia about those kind of things. But
yeah, I didn't consider I would expect that first it to be thought. Fine.
It should be fine, I'll say that. It's a question of how the BIOS is handled. And if it's handled by a partition inside that eMMC, bad things could happen.
So on the high end, the upboard with 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gig, I don't know if that's storage. I'm guessing it's storage, is $149.
Yeah, see, that's, I don't want to say that's almost fair, but if you just take the specs off of that board and then you go try to find a super low-end laptop or desktop or whatever, you're going to pay more.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what I did is I was looking around because I did want to test out an environment, and I went to Craigslist. I'm like, all right, if I wanted to do this on one box, I would be looking at least for a quad core and 32 gigs of RAM. And, you know, for under $300, maybe there were a couple of boxes for $150 that would have done it. But I do like the novelty and the stink cool thing. I don't know that this will run vSphere and ESX hosts, but if the hardware does work, that would be, you're definitely going to see me run around with a shoebox with like four or five of these in them.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. Then instead of having a data center in a drawer, you can have an entire legitimate data center with clustered computing in a shoebox.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of cool and crazy, I'll say that. Another one I just wanted to throw out there. We talked about Pi Zero clusters last week, and Eric was like, "Well, that's cool, but what would you use it for?" kind of thing. And Aaron responded. The very last link I literally just added, 216. Climbers.net, CLIMBERS.net. And there they have a way, and they're showing you how to set up the Raspberry Pi cluster, the Raspberry Pi Zero cluster on top of the Raspberry Pi. And they show you some of the performance metrics that you get out of it. Sorry. And what Aaron kind of hinted at in a, I believe a Google Plus posting was, unfortunately, just like we don't have all the software available to us on an ARM platform because it has to be developed and compiled for it, if you want to run things in a cluster like this, a Beowulf cluster like this, there has to be some sort of software running it at the front end that can actually hand out these tasks to all these multiple cores, all these multiple processors, which means you're probably only going to be able to run specialized software and get the actual performance out of all these devices. So you're not going to load anything on the Pi and see drastic improvements. You're going to have to run very specific programs. The only kind of stuff I know that might have clustering capabilities built in is like maybe Blender has some kind of clustering built into it. There is that open source networkable video editing software. I believe it's called OpenFlow. Klaatu down in New Zealand is a big fan of it. Flowblade. You know, might be able to take advantage of it. But literally, it's the kind of software I could probably count on my hand, the amount of software that could really support this. You're really doing it, dare I say, as a cool factor.
Right. Back in the day when, and I had always thought that if you're going to be using multiple machines to render 3D animations, that you had to do like a machine per block of pixels on a frame. But really what you did is if you had 1,000 frames, you split it up between 20 machines and they each get 50 frames. And that's how it works. And then you just combine them all together and boom, shoot out the video. So there's different ways of using multiple computers to do things. But like you said, if you're going to be doing something multiprocessor simultaneously, you do need special software to split up those tasks.
Yeah, and here's the dirty secret. A hell of a lot of software that we run today is not truly multi-core, multi-threadable. Today, Firefox 48 got released. It is the first version of Firefox that is truly multi-threading and multi-processor supported. So while we've had hyper-threads and multiple cores for years,
right,
and for decades, or for at least a decade, software is a little behind in this. And to be honest, a hell of a lot of games, too, don't do a good job of multi-threading.
Well, usually, yeah, you know, in the business world, we don't deal with too much multi-threading. And most of my programming experience is business and not actually near zero experience game-wise. And, multi-threading is a concept that most business programmers don't do. And I would say just generally most programmers don't do. And then if you're multi-threading and designing it to run on a multi-core computer, that's a whole different level. You know, you're not doing that with Java. You're not typically doing that with C. Typically, you're going to be writing assembler code.
Yeah, the only business application I can even consider, normal quote-unquote business application that might do multi-threading and multi-processor correctly, is maybe some sort of higher-end CAD program. Mm-hmm. And even though technically that's business software because structural engineers also use that kind of thing, not just animators. Yeah. that's cool. The only other one I have to throw out real quick, and it's only because I thought it looked cool again, and yes, it's, again, game-related. Line 212, and the real reason I'm bringing this is because of the guy's level of attention to detail and documentation. This is called Romtastic, R-O-M-T-A-S-T-I-C-K. It's a 3D-printed arcade console. Okay, it's essentially a joystick, six buttons, a pie with a little screen, and then a joystick and six buttons again, so you can play two-player games. Personally, me, it would have to be wider than this, or else one player is going to be elbowing the other player pretty incessantly, I'll say. But if you take a look at this, and it's at blog.backelite.com, if you just page down a couple times, you'll see the actual device coming together. This guy made something that looks pretty good. It has six buttons. It has one player, two player buttons, and has a couple extra buttons on the front facing, which I believe are like power buttons or the such.
Yeah, it again, pretty much looks like the width of a console, you know, like you'd see out in the wild. So yeah, I guess you know some of those games that you played two player.
Yeah, I keep thinking like Street Fighter. Or the kind of dare I say Karate Champ, but that's dating myself. kind of like fighting games. This could be really cool for. You're gonna need a bigger backpack though if you're gonna carry this around and take it over to somebody's house. This isn't something you can just easily carry around without at least people looking at you funny. Very cool. Okay, I really didn't have anything else that I could think of to bring up except. I've now been without a Pi top for about a month.
Oh, no.
I don't know what happened, but basically now there is no charge being held by the battery whatsoever. Oh. To actually use the device, it has to be plugged in. I hate the idea of carrying a power brick of any shape, form, factor around with me whatsoever. So it's literally just sitting down here in pieces. I'm waiting on a new bass and keyboard. To be shipped to me. It's coming from Hong Kong, so I don't expect it to be quick. Hopefully less than, a couple more weeks, because it's already been plenty of weeks. I hope it actually gets here a little bit quicker.
Aren't these the guys that heard you or saw a tweet and they, like, responded almost instantly?
Yes.
I remember that.
Yes. Yes, and I'm still waiting for the base device.
That's kind of a letdown.
I know. I just take it as they're on the other side of the planet. They have other people they have to supply product to. I'm not at the top of the list. I just hope they get better at turnaround as time goes on. Okay, and Brian, you wanted to do a little discussion here?
I'm actually good. I don't have anything.
Richard did.
Yeah, I posted a note. So one of the things Dor and I were talking about earlier today is running a router on a Pi device. And I remember there was, is it the Banana Pi RP1 or R1? Banana Pi R1. That's it.
Yeah.
Now, I saw one on eBay for $79. And it does do 802.11ac. I think it does 802.11n. I'm like, all right, that's cool. And it does look like it has, I think it has, a WAN port and four LAN ports. Let me see if I can bring up the right image that shows me the right side of the case. Anyhow, because, it has just kind of like your standard router. It'll have two antennas, four LAN ports, a WAN port, and it has just like the regular Raspberry Pi, the 40-pin header, and I think it has... All right, so you got USB and you got the HDMI on it also. Now, Dor and I were talking, I kind of segued into this because what was the Israeli company that was making a Banana Pi router?
It's a Solid Run. The same people who make the Q-Box, the 2x2-inch mini computer, are also coming out with a Clear Fog. They're calling it base single board computer to use as the base of a router or a routing type device.
Okay, so the reason I was looking at that, or let me go back to there. I got to click through. What was the dollar amount? Was it?
I want to say it was
Clear Fog. Buy now.
Clear Fog, smaller, cheaper measurement. Currently sells at $70.
Yeah. All right. On the website, it said 90.
Yeah.
Now, this, I don't believe, all right, there are some cool features. I don't want to throw them under the bus. Now, it really depends on your application as to what you want it and why you want it. The ClearFog, it runs OpenWRT, right? Let's see. Just want to make sure I'm telling it right. Has gigabit, gigabit Ethernet, and let's see. It has a socket for...
A MPCIe slot, which is something I never heard of before.
No, but there's another socket on it. It might be in this article I read.
Oh.
There's a socket for, like, Internet of Things, wireless communication, and I forget what the protocol was. Let me click back here. So if you're into the IoT stuff, that's going to be... And, look, I'm darn close to the IoT in my own home. All right, so it runs OpenWRT, and let's see, variety of standards. Oh, okay, so Zigbee and those type of networking, there's actually a micro bus boards will fit on it. There's a socket for that.
Wow.
So, I mean, that would probably be the selling point for me. I might say, but where's the Wi-Fi? You know, there's only two Ethernet ports, 2 gigabit Ethernet ports on it. So in my mind, well, router, yeah, I guess it works like a router. In the same way as I took an x86 with a floppy drive running -stein and any 2000 ISO cards and had a router. But what kind of knocks it over the top is, you know, the Zigbee socket. So if you want to do something like that, that's pretty stink cool. I'm hoping I'm wrong that there is Wi-Fi on board, because I'm looking at the image of it. And what happens with Wi-Fi manufacturers, because they have to be FCC certified, they're always a little daughter board. So even if you open up your laptop, you're going to see a little daughter board in there with the Wi-Fi on it. And typically that's how... So basically, Realtek or whoever the manufacturer is will get certified, and then they're going to have some sort of, you know, plug that they're going to plug into other devices or be soldered onto them, you know, some way of attaching them to another board. Because otherwise, I'm like, all right, how do I put Wi-Fi on this? I don't know what that other socket is on the end,
right?
Which right. It looks like it's RF shielded, like you would put some RF circuitry in there.
Well, if you take a look at the picture of the board, the board itself is a very, very, very dark green. There's a lighter green rectangle, which is a daughter board of Kind.
Right, that might be the Wi-Fi.
Right, or if you take a look at the opposite corner from where the power's at, you see two little rows of
that's
basically
for the
pin
Zigbee.
Connectors. That's the Zigbee, okay, because that looks like my Pine, how my Pine 64 Bluetooth Wi-Fi connected, because you're exactly right. It's a separate board that I had to clip on.
Are you guys looking at the Pro, the ClearFog Pro, or the base?
No, this one isn't even out yet. The two that are posted on Solid Run's website right now are older devices.
Okay.
This one is coming out here really soon, is the word they keep saying. And Solid Run is not known for being economical or cheap devices.
And, you know, I don't want to throw the cheaper economic... $90 is a reasonable price, and it has USB 3.0. If you're looking for something that's going to run Zigbee out of the box, that's stink cool. You know, that definitely makes it worth it. I, at first, was looking at it saying, well, wait a second, there's the Banana Pi R1 with 4 LAN ports and a WAN port, and it does 802.11n and all the other, you know, legacy wireless. Like, why wouldn't I want that? And I started looking around, and I could get that with a case and, you know, I think everything but a power supply for $79 on eBay, I'm assuming plus shipping.
Well, this is what I keep thinking. Remember back in the day, you would have your modem, then you would have your router, then you would have your wireless.
Yes.
Antenna as a separate device.
Yeah.
All three were separate devices. I think we're kind of either in that stage or in that mentality of separating out things where they only have two ports on this. My logic is maybe they're expecting you to have another device connected.
Right.
To do the actual splitting of the network cables to 5, 6, 8 devices.
Well,
I hope they don't expect the wireless to be on one of them.
Well, at $90, frick, I was just kind of Googling this before the show. You can get an 8-port, this is on Amazon, TP-Link 8-port gigabit switch for $27.99.
Yeah. Well, and have you seen the Steve Gibson device that he's been fawning over for the last couple weeks?
No, what's that?
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. SGGRC router. It was called Edge Router. Edge Router. And it's a little $50, $49 small device that has no wireless built in whatsoever. Okay, here you go. Ready? Link is coming into the notes on the very bottom line. Okay. Ubiquiti Edge Router X, very, very, very small. 5 ports on the back of it. One is for the WAN. 3 are definitely for the LAN internal. Then there's one at the very end, which is, I think it's for POEN.
No, it says the POEN.
The whole point of this device is it offers a lot of packet filtering, packet sniffering, virtual LANs. So each one of these NICs, you can supposedly, in the interface, very easily say, okay, this first NIC port is going to be my subnet 192.168.1.0 through 192.168.1.255 or 254. And this is supposed to be a smart brain of your network. Because here's one of the gimmicks I do believe. We all, in the future, are going to have multiple networks inside our house.
Well, I kind of do.
We're going to have our kid network. We're going to have our IoT network. We're going to have our backbone infrastructure network. Then we're going to have our play network.
And the file server with everything you don't want anybody ever to see.
Exactly, kind of thing. But, and like supposedly in this thing, hypothetically, you could say Ethernet 2 or NIC 2. That's the kid network. And right from this interface, you can say this network turns off at 9 p.m. And then you don't have to worry about anything ever coming in or going out on that network after 9 p.m. And it's completely isolated from everything else on your network.
Now, my Asus does that.
To me, this is the fracturing of the network out into smaller devices. And it's only $50, which I think is a fair price.
That's a no-brainer.
Yeah, and they're all gigabit NICs. And supposedly the firmware in here is based off of something that we all know of and heard of, but I can't remember what it was. If you have the desire to split out your network and have ridiculous control over packet filtering, deep packet inspection, stateless and stateful packet inspection and everything, then you really need to check out ubnt.com, and it's the Edge Router X.
I like that.
I'll say I'm very interested by it. I don't know if I'm going to pull the trigger just yet, but I'm very interested by it.
Yeah, the stateful packet inspection has kind of been around for a while, but the deep packet inspection, not a whole lot of off-the-shelf routers would have something like that, and that's very key. But most of this, what you've talked about, you can do with a Cisco switch. You know, you can buy a Cisco.
Well, how much is a Cisco switch?
Well, no, I meant like an oldie but goodie type of...
with no support?
With no support, yeah.
Yeah, well, this thing has support, number one. Number two, takes up a hell of a lot less room. I mean, I haven't seen too many small Cisco switches in my life. I've seen gigantic ones.
Okay, I just really disappointed myself. So I have, I guess it's maybe a two-year-old Asus router. It's the RTAC68U. And it allows me to have, you know, it's 802.11ac, so I have 2.4 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz. I have a guest network on both 2.4 and 5, and I have my regular network. Well, guess what? All the guest network is you don't give them your home password. You give them the guest password.
Right.
So I thought
it isn't truly isolated.
Yeah, I thought it was like a VLAN.
No.
So I just connected my laptop to the guest network and pinged one of my Raspberry Pis, and sure enough.
Yeah. And another little hidden functionality in this that they haven't officially even documented yet is you can connect to this via basically like a console, and you can SSH into the device, and you can run things like OpenVPN on it as well.
That's cool.
I'm sure Cisco has more functionality, no doubt in my mind. For $50, this to me, this hits almost the sweet spot of functionality and price.
Yes.
And it's a new device, so hopefully they're going to keep supporting it, keep updating it, keep enhancing what it can do. But to have somebody like Steve Gibson be nearly giddy over it, I think kind of says something. because he said for years, and I literally, in my house, for well over a decade, I had the three routers set up to where I had isolated networks. I had my internet connection, I had my modem, I had my wired router, and then off of that, I had two other routers. One was for customer computers and one was for my house and everything else. That was to be sure that any customer computer I connected to my home network had zero chance of infecting anything on my home network.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm going to keep this in my queue. I'm not buying one now. I might buy one soon because I do see the need of when my son especially launches up his Amazon Kindle Fire tablet. Literally, he powers that thing on. Right after he powers that thing on, nothing else in the house works on wireless for like 30 seconds. Everything. The Roku, the Odroid running Android for the home theater, my son's phone, my phone, the Pis, everything else stops working for 30 seconds. So I would really like to have him on his own network.
Absolutely. You posted something like this a few weeks ago, and someone responded back saying that the processors that they make for this device probably isn't as good as another brand. I can't remember which one it was.
Well, that's the whole thing. I guarantee you, if you home build your own solution, it's going to be 10 times more powerful than this device. But again, this device is only $50.
Yeah.
Hopefully all the firmware in it is secure. And I'll tell you, it's a pretty deep one. It's actually, he said the features and availability do compare to Cisco or pfSense in functionality, which is, you know, pfSense I know is powerful. Cisco I know is powerful. So for $50, you get that same kind of functionality. It's pretty impressive. I think when it comes time for me to split my network, I probably will build mine myself. I don't know if I'll be using something like the Solid Run Box or the Rat or the Banana R1. I don't know, but I know all I really need is a smart box with at least two NICs in it, one for incoming, one for outgoing. Then the question is how am I going to split my network? Am I going to have that box with multiple NICs, or am I going to pass that responsibility down the network? I don't know. I think it's cool stuff though.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Do you guys have anything you wanted to tack on here at the end?
Well, I'm going to ask, do you have Wi-Fi calling on your cell phone?
My oldest son does, yes.
Okay. So one of the cool things, or as a consultant, I have, sometimes I'll have a lot of calls that will have many hour-long meetings, which towards the end of the month will tip me over the end. And what I found is I can force my phone to Wi-Fi call. So what I do is I go to airplane mode, and that shuts down all the radios. And then you turn on the Wi-Fi only. And then all of your calls go in and out over Wi-Fi, and they're not charged, at least with my plan.
What kind of device do you have?
I've got a Note 4, and it's on Verizon.
Huh.
And it just went to Marshmallow.
Gotcha. That's cool. I'll have to definitely try that on mine. I will say, I don't know how, because I have a quote-unquote foreign phone, one of them foreign phones. Got a OnePlus One, which is now, I think, 3 years old. So I don't know if I'd have that kind of functionality. But my son is running the Oppo R7 Plus, and it's basically built right in. It just says Wi-Fi calling enabled, and it works.
The, what is it, the Google Voice has Wi-Fi calling enabled by default. So if you're using their app to make and receive phone calls, you don't necessarily have to do anything special.
Yeah, and I'll say, as long as I'm on my home Wi-Fi or I'm getting really strong LTE, I've had great success with that. Mm. Because that's the phone number that I give everybody. But I know when I pick up the phone and say hello, I know when I'm in a not great coverage zone because it sounds horrible and it's laggy.
Oh, really?
And it, Yeah. At least on my phone and my plan with my carrier, it can get pretty bad. But again, I'm not on Verizon. I'm not on the big V. I'm on T-Mobile, which isn't the best network out there.
All right. There might be a few things you don't know about Google Voice, which I just did a little bit of research into and found it stupid cool. So if you get calls, one, if you give out your Google Voice number to everybody, it doesn't matter what carrier you have in the future, or if you get mad at them and you break up in an unhappy way, you didn't lose the phone number you gave everybody.
Right.
Now, the other thing about Google Voice, as long as you're still romantically involved with Google Voice, you're okay. So now, the good thing about Google Voice is you can whitelist the numbers. So you can say, hey, if they're in my phone book, they're whitelisted. Now, what it will do, if a number calls you, like, hi, this is your auto warranty company. It's like, no, you are not my auto warranty company because I don't have an auto warranty company. So they'll call you up, but what they do get, so the robocaller dials you, and it wants to connect a person to the line once you pick up. But what your Google Voice does, if it's not on your whitelist, if you select that, hey, I'm going to whitelist people in my address book. People that are not in my address book are not whitelisted, and they have to announce themselves. And then you push, like, it'll play, you know, Steve Gibson just called. Or, you know, it plays their name. It's like, please leave your name after the beep. And to announce yourself. And then that call gets to you. And then you can say accept or reject. Now, the other thing you can do is blacklist. Now, I had a service, you know, they're calling me, financial institution I deal with. Everything is up to snuff perfect. I said, look, I got a 15-day grace period on this. Why are you calling me day two? This is ridiculous. You got to stop. Like, oh, I'm sorry, sir. We're not able to do that. If you want me to remove you from the list, you have to write a letter to. I'm like, I'm not writing a letter. And that's what I found. I can go in and I can blacklist. And they will actually get the do-do-do-do. This number has been disconnected.
Oh, wow.
So I thought that was stink cool also.
Okay, how much of this do you know can you do from your mobile device?
Well, this is Google Voice.
Well, no, but the only way I was able to figure out how to record my greeting for everyone and turn that feature on was through the web interface at google.com/voice.
Right,
and then
likewise.
Okay. So I wasn't sure if there was something on the phone that I'd missed. So you got to go to a desktop computer to enable this, but then you reap the benefits on your mobile
Correct.
Device. Yeah, and I'll say Google Voice at my computer using my real microphone and my real headphones, the quality I get out of that when I call a real phone number from that is sickening.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It is so good. It is gold. It's perfect. This is the kind of thing where I think having Google Voice connected to home phones has to be a better solution, quality-wise at least.
Now, I know buddies of mine that are Android guys, and I call them, it's like they're in the same room. I don't know if it's the HD calling is enabled, but it is phenomenal.
Yeah, HD calling is really, really good, especially if you have headsets, the two earbuds with a microphone. It just feels like you're talking to someone face-to-face. It's very enhanced.
Well, I don't know if you all realize, but what happens, the way they get so many cell numbers on a tower or so many cell calls working on a tower is they compress the dynamic range, you know, the low frequency and the high frequency, which kind of muddies up the call and sometimes makes it difficult to hear, which means maybe your call isn't as short as it should be because you're saying what? And they're making more money on it.
Yeah, go figure. Yeah, and I will say in the future, right now, phones have multiple radios in them. Volt or VOLTE is becoming a real thing slowly over time, like on T of the mobile. I know if I would have bought the OnePlus 2, for instance, in like a year or two, supposedly, I would not be able to make voice calls because the phone and the device have to support VOLTE moving forward. And that kind of stuff is moving forward, supposedly going to help with call quality. I don't believe a single thing phone carriers say, so this is the kind of thing we have to wait and see. But I know for the time being, when I'm on Wi-Fi at home and I use Google Voice, I get ridiculously good performance. Very cool. And hopefully they don't kill Google Voice here soon.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know,
Knock on wood.
They're Google at any point in time. They could just pull the plug.
That is correct.
I'd rather pay for it than just pull the plug.
Well, that's the whole thing. Over time, I'm becoming the guy that believes if I don't pay for something,
it may not exist.
The clock is ticking. Yeah, yeah. I am the product, not the customer, and eventually it's just going to die. Okay, guys, definitely had a good show here this week. I want to encourage everyone, if you want to contact us, just go to podnos.com, click on contact, Mini PC Show. The reason I say to do that is because then your email subject line is standardized and you stick out, and it's very easy to tell when you send us an email through that system. You can always send us a voicemail, like Eric said earlier, 7076-PODNUT. We get them, we come in, very easy to hook up to my mixer here and play on the show. And I'm going to say it again, if you guys want extra content of any kind, let me know, and I will work on getting a Patreon set up and running so we can do extra things. Because these mini computers, like I said before, are only becoming ridiculously more popular in numbers as time goes on. And my Pine 64 I've been running now for at least 2 or 3 weeks with my Xubuntu desktop on it, 1604, running Midori. It turns out Midori is the default browser on ARM processors, seems to be more stable. The only problems I had in the past was when I was trying to run Firefox as my browser. So I'm very tempted to load Arbian and other distributions on my other Pi devices, load Midori, and see how my experience is there. That's everything we got. I will thank everyone for downloading. Thank everyone for subscribing. Thank everyone for going to the website and sending us emails. We will talk to everyone in about a week.